Wiley Audio is pleased to present The Alchemy of Finance, Reading the Mind of the Market by George Soros. Your reader is Grover Gardner. Introduction. In a very real sense, this book is my life's work. It touches on many of my most abiding interests, and it brings together the two main strands in my intellectual development, one abstract and one practical. The abstract came first. Ever since I became conscious of my existence, I've had a passionate interest in understanding it, and I regarded my own understanding as the central problem that needed to be understood. To understand oneself is an impossible task. To achieve anything resembling knowledge, we must be able to draw a distinction between subject and object. Yet in this case, the two are the same. What one thinks is part of what one thinks about. Therefore, one's thinking lacks an independent point of reference by which it can be judged. It lacks objectivity. As an undergraduate, I studied economics, but I found economic theory highly unsatisfactory because it failed to come to grips with this problem. Indeed, it went through great contortions to avoid it. Economics seeks to be a science. Science is supposed to be objective, and it is difficult to be scientific when the subject matter, the participant in the economic process, lacks objectivity. I was greatly influenced at the time by Karl Popper's ideas on scientific method. I accepted most of his views, with one major exception. He argued in favor of what he called unity of method. That is, the methods and criteria that apply to the study of natural phenomena also apply to the study of social events. I felt that there was a fundamental difference between the two. The events studied by the social sciences have thinking participants. Natural phenomena do not. The participants' thinking creates problems that have no counterpart in natural science. The closest analogy is in quantum physics, where scientific observation gives rise to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. But in social events, it is the participants' thinking that is responsible for the element of uncertainty, not the outside observer. Natural science studies events that consist of a sequence of facts. When events have thinking participants, the subject matter is no longer confined to facts, but also includes the participants' perceptions. The chain of causation does not lead directly from fact to fact, but from fact to perception and from perception to fact. This would not create any insuperable difficulties if there were some kind of correspondence or equivalence between facts and perceptions. Unfortunately, that is impossible because the participants' perceptions do not relate to facts, but to a situation that is contingent on their own perceptions and therefore cannot be treated as a fact. Economic theory tries to sidestep the issue by introducing the assumption of rational behavior. People are assumed to act by choosing the best of the available alternatives, but somehow the distinction between perceived alternatives and facts is assumed away. The result is a theoretical construction of great elegance that resembles natural science, but does not resemble reality. It relates to an ideal world in which participants act on the basis of perfect knowledge, and it produces a theoretical equilibrium in which the allocation of resources is at an optimum. It has little relevance to the real world in which people act on the basis of imperfect understanding, and equilibrium is beyond reach. The relationship between the participants' understanding and the situation in which they participate continued to preoccupy me long after I left college. My first priority was to try and make a living, but in my spare time I wrote a philosophical treatise on the subject with the catchy title, The Burden of Consciousness. Unfortunately, the title was the best part of it. By the time I finished, I disagreed with my own presentation. I spent 3 years revising it. One day I reread what I had written the day before, and I could not make head or tail of it. It made me realize that I had reached a dead end, and I decided to give it up. That was when the practical streak in me began to dominate my intellectual development. If I had to sum up my practical skills, I would use one word: survival. When I was an adolescent, the Second World War gave me a lesson that I have never forgotten. I was fortunate enough to have a father who was highly skilled in the art of survival, having lived through the Russian Revolution as an escaped prisoner of war. Under his tutelage, the Second World War served as an advanced course at a tender age. As the reader shall see, the investment vehicle I created a quarter of a century later drew heavily on skills I learned as an adolescent. After leaving college, I had a number of false starts and finally became an international arbitrage trader in stocks, first in London and then in New York. When the European Common Market was formed in 1957, American investors became interested in European shares. I became a security analyst advising American institutions on their European investments, and for a brief period I ruled as a one-eyed king among the blind. My glory came to an abrupt end when President Kennedy introduced a so-called interest equalization tax, which effectively stopped purchases of foreign securities. I decided to put my money-making activities on the back burner and spent 3 years, from 1963 to 1966, revising The Burden of Consciousness. When I finally decided to return to the land of the living, I started a model portfolio that became a hedge fund, a mutual fund that employs leverage and uses various techniques of hedging, in 1969. I have been in charge of that fund ever since, although I delegated much of the responsibility to others between September 1981 and September 1984. The fund has grown from about $4 million at inception to nearly $2 billion, and most of the growth has been internally generated. Original investors have seen the value of their shares multiply 300-fold. No investment fund has ever produced comparable results. In the first 10 years of my business career, I had not much use for anything I had learned in college, and there was an almost total separation between my practical activities and my theoretical interests. Selling and trading in securities was a game I played without putting my true self on the line. All this changed when I became a fund manager. I was putting my money where my mouth was, and I could not afford to dissociate myself from my investment decisions. I had to use all my intellectual resources, and I discovered, to my great surprise and gratification, that my abstract ideas came in very handy. It would be an exaggeration to say that they accounted for my success, but there can be no doubt that they gave me an edge. I developed my own peculiar approach to investing, which was at loggerheads with the prevailing wisdom. The generally accepted view is that markets are always right. That is, market prices tend to discount future developments accurately even when it is unclear what those developments are. I start with the opposite point of view. I believe that market prices are always wrong in the sense that they present a biased view of the future. But distortion works in both directions. Not only do market participants operate with a bias, but their bias can also influence the course of events. This may create the impression that markets anticipate future developments accurately, but in fact it is not present expectations that correspond to future events, but future events that are shaped by present expectations. The participants' perceptions are inherently flawed, and there is a two-way connection between flawed perceptions and the actual course of events, which results in a lack of correspondence between the two. I call this two-way connection reflexivity. In the course of my investment activities, I discovered that financial markets operate on a principle that is somehow akin to scientific method. Making an investment decision is like formulating a scientific hypothesis and submitting it to a practical test. The main difference is that the hypothesis that underlies an investment decision is intended to make money and not to establish a universally valid generalization. Both activities involve significant risk, and success brings a corresponding reward, monetary in one case and scientific in the other. Taking this view, it is possible to see financial markets as a laboratory for testing hypotheses, albeit not strictly scientific ones. The truth is, successful investing is a kind of alchemy. Most market participants do not view markets in this light. That means that they do not know what hypotheses are being tested. It also means that most of the hypotheses that are submitted to market testing are quite banal. Usually, they amount to nothing more than the assertion that a particular stock is going to outperform the market averages. I had a certain advantage over other investors because at least I had an idea about the way financial markets operate. I would be lying, however, if I claimed that I could always formulate worthwhile hypotheses on the basis of my theoretical framework. Sometimes there were no reflexive processes to be found. Sometimes I failed to find them. And what was the most painful of all, sometimes I got them wrong. One way or another, I often invested without a worthwhile hypothesis, and my activities were not very different from a random walk. But I was attuned to reflexive processes in financial markets, and my major successes came from exploiting the opportunities they presented.